The three of them moved across the clearing, Eddie pushing Susanna, who held the bag of hides in her lap. The pocket in the back of her wheelchair was stuffed with other items. The piece of wood with the slingshot still mostly hidden inside it was only one of them. From behind them, the bear continued to roar out its final communication to the world, telling them shutdown would be complete in 40 minutes. Eddie couldn't wait. The broken spruces leaned in toward each other, forming a rude gate, and Eddie thought, this is where the quest for Roland's Dark Tower really begins. At least for us. He thought of his dream again. The spiraling windows issuing their unfurling flags of darkness, flags which spread over the field of roses like a stain. And as they passed beneath the leaning trees, a deep shudder gripped him. 22. They were able to use the wheelchair longer than Roland had expected. The firs of this forest were very old, and their spreading branches had created a deep carpet of needles, which discouraged most undergrowth. Susanna's arms were strong, stronger than Eddie's, although Roland did not think that would be true much longer, and she wheeled herself along easily over the level, shady forest floor. When they came to one of the trees the bear had pushed over, Roland lifted her out of the chair, and Eddie boosted it over the obstacle. From behind them, only a little deadened by distance, the bear told them at the top of its mechanical voice that the capacity of its last operating nuclear subcell was now negligible. "I hope you keep that damn harness lying empty over your shoulders all day," Susanna shouted at the gunslinger. Roland agreed, but less than 15 minutes later the land began to slope downward, and this old section of the forest began to be invaded with smaller, younger trees, birch, alder, and a few stunted maples, scrabbling grimly in the soil for purchase. The carpet of needles thinned, and the wheels of Susanna's chair began to catch in the low, tough bushes which grew in the alleys between the trees. Their thin branches boinged and rattled in the stainless steel spokes. Eddie threw his weight against the handles, and they were able to go on for another quarter of a mile that way. Then the slope began to grow more steep, and the ground underfoot became mushy. "Time for a pigback, lady," Roland said.
"Let's try the chair a little longer. What do you say? Going might get easier."
Roland shook his head. "If you try that hill, you'll—what did you call it, Eddie? Do a dugout?" Eddie shook his head, grinning.
"It's called doing a donut, Roland, a term from my misspent sidewalk surfing days.
Whatever you call it, it means landing on your head. Come on, Susanna, up you come."
"I hate being a cripple," Susanna said crossly,
but allowed Eddie to hoist her out of the chair and worked with him to seat herself firmly in the harness Roland wore on his back. Once she was in place, she touched the butt of Roland's pistol.
"Y'all want this baby?"
she asked Eddie. He shook his head.
"You're faster, and you know it, too."
She grunted and adjusted the belt, settling the gun butt so it was easily accessible to her right hand.
"I'm slowing you boys down, and I know that. But if we ever make it to some good old two-lane blacktop, I'll leave the both of you kneeling in the blocks."
"I don't doubt it," Roland said, and then cocked his head. The woods had fallen silent.
"Brer Bear's finally given up," Susanna said.
"Praise God."
"I thought it still had 7 minutes to go," Eddie said.
Roland adjusted the straps of the harness. "Its clock must have started running a little slow during the last 500 or 600 years.
"You really think it was that old, Roland?"
Roland nodded. "At least. And now it's past. The last of the 12 Guardians, for all we know."
"Yeah, ask me if I give a shit," Eddie replied, and Susanna laughed.
"Are you comfortable?" Roland asked her.
"No, my butt hurts already, but go on. Just try not to drop me."
Roland nodded and started down the slope. Eddie followed, pushing the empty chair and trying not to bang it too badly on the rocks which had begun to jut out of the ground like big white knuckles. Now that the bear had finally shut up, he thought the forest seemed much too quiet. It almost made him feel like a character in one of those hokey old jungle movies about cannibals and giant apes. 23. The bear's back trail was easy to find, but tougher to follow.
5 miles or so out of the clearing, it led them through a low, boggy area that was not quite a swamp. By the time the ground began to rise and firm up a little again, Roland's faded jeans were soaked to the knees, and he was breathing in long, steady rasps. Still, he was in slightly better shape than Eddie, who had found wrestling Susanna's wheelchair through the muck and standing water hard going.
"Time to rest and eat something," Roland said.
"Oh, boy, gimme eats," Eddie puffed.
He helped Susanna out of the harness and set her down on the bole of a fallen tree with claw marks slashed into its trunk in long diagonal grooves. Then he half sat, half collapsed next to her.
"You got my wheelchair pretty muddy, white boy," Susanna said. "It's all gonna be in my repote."
He cocked an eyebrow at her.
"Next car wash we come to, I'll push you through myself. I'll even turtle wax a goddamn thing, okay?"
She smiled. "You got a date, handsome."
Eddie had one of Roland's water skins cinched around his waist. He tapped it.
"Okay?"
"Yes," Roland said. "Not too much now. A little more for all of us before we set out again. That way no one takes a cramp."
"Roland, Eagle Scout of Oz," Eddie said and giggled as he unslung the water skin.
"What is this Oz?"
"A make-believe place in a movie," Susanna said.
"Oz was a lot more than that. My brother Henry used to read me the stories once in a while. I'll tell you one some night, Roland."
"That would be fine," the gunslinger replied seriously. "I am hungry to know more of your world."
"Oz isn't our world, though. Like Susanna said, it's a make-believe place."
Roland handed them chunks of meat which had been wrapped in broad leaves of some sort.
"The quickest way to learn about a new place is to know what it dreams of. I would hear of this Oz."
"Okay, that's a date, too. Suze can tell you the one about Dorothy and Toto and the Tin Woodman, and I'll tell you all the rest."
He bit into his piece of meat and rolled his eyes approvingly. It had taken the flavor of the leaves in which it had been rolled and was delicious. Eddie wolfed his ration, stomach gurgling busily all the while. Now that he was getting his breath back, he felt good. Great, in fact. His body was growing a solid sheath of muscle, and every part of it felt at peace with every other part.
"Don't worry," he thought. "Everything will be arguing again by tonight. I think he's going to push on until I'm ready to drop in my tracks."
Susanna ate more delicately, chasing every second or third bite with a little sip of water, turning the meat in her hands, eating from the outside in.
"Finish what you started last night," she invited Roland. "You said you thought you understood these conflicting memories of yours."
Roland nodded. "Yes. I think both memories are true. One is a little truer than the other, but that does not negate the truth of that other."
"Makes no sense to me," Eddie said. "Either this boy Jake was at the way station or he wasn't, Roland."
"It is a paradox, something that is and isn't at the same time. Until it's resolved, I will continue divided. That's bad enough, but the basic split is widening. I can feel that happening. It is unspeakable."
"What do you think caused it?" Susanna asked.
"I told you the boy was pushed in front of a car. Pushed. Now who do we know who like to push people in front of things?" Understanding dawned in her face.
"Jack Mort. Do you mean he was the one who pushed this boy into the street?"
"Yes."
"But you said the man in black did it," Eddie objected. "Your buddy Walter. You said that the boy saw him. A man who looked like a priest. Didn't the kid even hear him say he was? Let me through, I'm a priest, something like that?"
"Oh, Walter was there. They were both there, and they both pushed Jake."
"Somebody bring the Thorazine and a straitjacket," Eddie called. "Roland just went over to Highside."
Roland paid no attention to this. He was coming to understand that Eddie's jokes and clowning were his way of dealing with stress. Cuthbert had not been much different, as Susanna was, in her way, not so different from Elaine.
"What exasperates me about all of this," he said, "is that I should have known. I was in Jack Mort, after all, and I had access to his thoughts, just as I had access to yours, Eddie, and yours, Susanna. I saw Jake while I was in Mort, I saw him through Mort's eyes, and I knew Mort planned to push him. Not only that, I stopped him from doing it. All I had to do was enter his body. Not that he knew that was what it was. He was concentrating so hard on what he planned to do that he actually thought I was a fly landing on his neck. Eddie began to understand. If Jake wasn't pushed into the street, he never died. And if he never died, he never came into this world. And if he never came into this world, you never met him at the way station. Right?
Right. The thought even crossed my mind that if Jack Mort meant to kill the boy, I would have to stand aside and let him do it, to avoid creating the very paradox that is tearing me apart. But I couldn't do that.
You couldn't kill this kid twice, could you?
Eddie asked softly.
Every time I just about make up my mind that you're as mechanical as that bear, you surprise me with something that actually seems human. God damn.
Quit it, Eddie, Susanna said. Eddie took a look at the gunslinger's slightly lowered face and grimaced.
Sorry, Roland. My mother used to say that my mouth had a bad habit of running away with my mind.
It's all right. I had a friend who was the same way.
Cuthbert?
Roland nodded. He looked at his diminished right hand for a long moment, then clenched it into a painful fist, sighed, and looked up at them again. Somewhere deeper in the forest, a lark sang sweetly. Here is what I believe. If I had not entered Jack Mort when I did, he still wouldn't have pushed Jake that day. Not then. Why not? Quartet. Simply that. For the first time since the last of the friends with whom I set forth on this quest died, I have found myself once again at the center of Quartet.
Quartet?
Eddie asked doubtfully. The gunslinger shook his head. Ka, the word you think of as destiny, Eddie, although the actual meaning is much more complex and hard to define, as is almost always the case with words of the high speech. And Tet, which means a group of people with the same interests and goals. We three are a Tet, for instance. Ka-Tet is the place where many lives are joined by fate.
Like in the Bridge of St. Louis Ray, Susanna murmured.
What's that? Roland asked.
A story about some people who die together when the bridge they're crossing collapses. It's famous in our world.
Roland nodded his understanding. In this case, Quartet bound Jake, Walter, Jack Mort, and me. There was no trap, as I first suspected when I realized who Jack Mort meant to be his next victim, because Quartet cannot be changed or bent to the will of any one person. But Quartet can be seen, known, and understood. Walter saw, and Walter knew.
The gunslinger struck his thigh with his fist and exclaimed bitterly, "How he must have been laughing inside when I finally caught up to him."
"Let's go back to what would have happened if you hadn't messed up Jack Mort's plans on the day he was following Jake," Eddie said. "You're saying that if you hadn't stopped Mort, someone or something else would have, is that right?"
"Yes, because it wasn't the right day for Jake to die. It was close to the right day, but not the right day."
I felt that, too. Perhaps just before he did it, Mort would have seen someone watching him, or a perfect stranger would have intervened,
or a cop, Susanna said. He might have seen a cop in the wrong place and at the wrong time.
Yes. The exact reason, the agent of Quartet, doesn't matter. I know from first-hand experience that Mort was as wily as an old fox. If he sensed any slightest thing wrong, he would have called it off and waited for another day. I know something else as well. He hunted in disguise. On the day he dropped the brick on Detta Holmes's head, he was wearing a knitted cap and an old sweater several sizes too big for him. He wanted to look like a wine bibber because he pushed the brick from a building where a large number of sots kept their dens. You see? They nodded.
On the day years later, when he pushed you in front of the train, Susanna, he was dressed as a construction worker. He was wearing a big yellow helmet he thought of as a hard hat, and a fake mustache. On the day when he actually would have pushed Jake into traffic, causing his death, he would have been dressed as a priest.
Jesus,
Susanna nearly whispered. The man who pushed him in New York was Jack Mort, and the man he saw at the way station was this fellow you were chasing, Walter.
Yes.
And the little boy thought they were the same man because they were both wearing the same kind of black robe?
Roland nodded. There was even a physical resemblance between Walter and Jack Mort. Not as if they were brothers, I don't mean that, but both were tall men with dark hair and very pale complexions. And given the fact that Jake was dying when he got his only good look at Mort, and was in a strange place and scared almost witless when he got his only good look at Walter, I think his mistake was both understandable and forgivable. If there's a horse's ass in this picture, it's me for not realizing the truth sooner.
Would Mort have known he was being used? Eddie asked. Thinking back to his own experiences and wild thoughts when Roland had invaded his mind, he didn't see how Mort could not know. But Roland was shaking his head. Walter would have been extremely subtle. Mort would have thought the priest disguise his own idea, or so I believe. He would not have recognized the voice of an intruder, of Walter, whispering deep within his mind, telling him what to do.
Jack Mort, Eddie marveled. It was Jack Mort all the time.
Yes, with assistance from Walter. And so I ended up saving Jake's life after all. When I made Mort jump from the subway platform in front of the train, I changed everything.
Susanna asked, if this Walter was able to enter our world through his own private door, maybe, whenever he wanted, couldn't he have used someone else to push your little boy? If he could suggest to Mort that he dress up like a priest, then he could make somebody else do it.
What, Eddie, why are you shaking your head?
Because I don't think Walter would want that to happen.
What Walter wanted is what is happening, for Roland to be losing his mind bit by bit.
Isn't that right?
The gunslinger nodded.
Walter couldn't have done it that way even if he had wanted to, Eddie added, because he was dead long before Roland found the doors on the beach. When Roland went through that last one and into Jack Mort's head, old Walt's messing around days were done.
Susanna thought about this, then nodded her head.
I see. I think. This time travel business is some confusing shit, isn't it?
Roland began to pick up his goods and strap them back into place.
Time we were moving on. Eddie stood up and shrugged into his pack.
You can take comfort from one thing at least, he told Roland. You or this cartet business were able to save the kid after all.
Roland had been knotting the harness strings at his chest. Now he looked up, and the blazing clarity of his eyes made Eddie flinch backward.
Have I? He asked harshly. Have I really? I'm going insane, an inch at a time, trying to live with two versions of the same reality. I had hoped at first that one or the other would begin to fade away, but that's not happening. In fact, the exact opposite is happening. Those two realities are growing louder and louder in my head, clamoring at each other like opposing factions which must soon go to war. So tell me this, Eddie. How do you suppose Jake feels? How do you suppose it feels to know you are dead in one world and alive in another?
The lark sang again, but none of them noticed. Eddie stared into the faded blue eyes blazing out of Roland's pale face and could not think of a thing to say.
They camped about 15 miles due east of the Dead Bear that night, slept the sleep of the completely exhausted. Even Roland slept the night through, although his dreams were nightmare carnival rides, and were up the next morning at sunrise. Eddie kindled a small fire without speaking, and glanced at Susanna as a pistol shot rang out in the woods nearby.
Breakfast, she said.
Roland returned 3 minutes later with a hide slung over one shoulder. On it lay the freshly gutted corpse of a rabbit. Susanna cooked it, they ate, and moved on. Eddie kept trying to imagine what it would be like to have a memory of your own death. On that one, he kept coming up short. Shortly after noon, they entered an area where most of the trees had been pulled over and the bushes mashed flat. It looked as though a cyclone had touched down here many years before, creating a wide and dismal alley of destruction. "We're close to the place we want to find," Roland said. He pulled down everything to clear the sight lines. Our friend the bear wanted no surprises. He was big but not complacent.
"Has it left us any surprises?" Eddie asked.
"He may have done so." Roland smiled a little and touched Eddie on the shoulder. "But there's this. There'll be old surprises." Their progress through this zone of destruction was slow. Most of the fallen trees were very old. Many had almost rejoined the soil from which they had sprung. But they still made enough of a tangle to create a formidable obstacle course. It would have been difficult enough if all three of them had been able-bodied. With Susanna strapped to the gunslinger's back in her harness, it became an exercise in aggravation and endurance. The flattened trees and jumbles of underbrush served to obscure the bear's back trail, and that also worked to slow their speed. Until midday, they had followed claw marks as clear as trail blazes on the trees. Here, however, near its starting point, the bear's rage had not been full-blown, and these handy signs of its passage disappeared. Roland moved slowly, looking for droppings in the bushes and tufts of hair on the tree trunks over which the bear had climbed. It took all afternoon to cross 3 miles of this decayed jumble. Eddie had just decided they were going to lose the light and would have to camp in these creepy surroundings when they came to a thin skirt of alders. Beyond it, he could hear a stream babbling noisily over a bed of stones. Behind them, the setting sun was radiating spokes of sullen red light across the jumbled ground they had just crossed, turning the fallen trees into crisscrossing black shapes like Chinese ideograms. Roland called a halt and eased Susanna down. He stretched his back, twisting it this way and that with his hands on his hips. "That it for the night?" Eddie asked. Roland shook his head. "Give Eddie your gun, Susanna." She did as he said, looking at him questioningly. "Come on, Eddie. The place we want is on the other side of those trees. We'll have a look. We might do a little work as well."
"What makes you think—"
"Open your ears." Eddie listened and realized he heard machinery. He further realized that he had been hearing it for some time now.
"I don't want to leave Susanna."
"We're not going far, and she has a good loud voice. Besides, if there's danger, it's ahead. We'll be between it and her." Eddie looked down at Susanna.
"Go on, just make sure you're back soon."
She looked back the way they had come with thoughtful eyes.
"I don't know if there's haunts here or not, but it feels like there are."
"We'll be back before dark," Roland promised. He started toward the screen of alders, and after a moment, Eddie followed him. 26. 15 yards into the trees, Eddie realized that they were following a path, one the bear had probably made for itself over the years. The alders bent above them in a tunnel. The sounds were louder now, and he began to sort them out. One was a low, deep humming noise. He could feel it in his feet, a faint vibration, as if some large piece of machinery was running in the earth. Above it, closer and more urgent, were crisscrossing sounds like bright scratches, squeals, squeaks, chitterings. Roland placed his mouth against Eddie's ear and said, "I think there's little danger if we're quiet." They moved on another 5 yards, and then Roland stopped again. He drew his gun and used the barrel to brush aside a branch which hung heavy with sunset-tinted leaves. Eddie looked through this small opening and into the clearing where the bear had lived for so long, the base of operations from which he had set forth on his many expeditions of pillage and terror. There was no undergrowth here. The ground had been beaten bald long since. A stream emerged from the base of a rock wall about 50 feet high and ran through the arrowhead-shaped clearing. On their side of the stream, backed up against the wall, was a metal box about 9 feet high. Its roof was curved, and it reminded Eddie of a subway entrance. The front was painted in diagonal yellow and black stripes. The earth, which floored the clearing, was not black like the topsoil in the forest, but a strange, powdery gray. It was littered with bones, and after a moment Eddie realized that what he had taken for gray soil was more bones. Bones so old they were crumbling back to dust. Things were moving in the dirt. The things making the squealing, chittering noises. Five of them. Small metal devices, the largest about the size of a collipop. They were robots, Eddie realized, or something like robots. They were similar to each other and to the bear they had undoubtedly served in one way only. Atop each of them, a tiny radar dish turned rapidly. More thinking caps, Eddie thought. My God, what kind of world is this, anyway? The largest of these devices looked a little like the Tonka tractor Eddie had gotten for his 6th or 7th birthday. Its treads churned up tiny gray clouds of bone dust as it rolled along. Another looked like a stainless steel rat. A third appeared to be a snake, constructed of jointed steel segments. It writhed and humped its way along. They formed a rough circle on the far side of the stream, going around and around on a deep course they had carved in the ground. Looking at them made Eddie think of cartoons he had seen and the stacks of old Saturday Evening Post magazines his mother had for some reason saved and stored in the front hall of their apartment. In the cartoons, worried cigarette-smoking men paced ruts in the carpet while they waited for their wives to give birth. As his eyes grew used to the simple geography of the clearing, Eddie saw that there were a great many more than 5 of these assorted freaks. There were at least a dozen others that he could see, and probably more hidden behind the bony remains of the bear's old kills. The difference was that the others weren't moving. The members of the bear's mechanical retinue had died one by one over the long years, until just this little group of 5 were left. And they did not sound very healthy with their squeaks and squalls and rusty chitterings. The snake in particular had a hesitant, crippled look as it followed the mechanical rat around and around the circle. Every now and then the device which followed the snake, a steel block that walked on stubby mechanical legs, would catch up with it and give the snake a nudge, as if telling it to hurry the fuck up. Eddie wondered what their job had been. Surely not protection, the bear had been built to protect itself. And Eddie guessed that if old Shardik had come upon the 3 of them while still in its prime, it would have chewed them up and spat them out in short order. Perhaps these little robots had been its maintenance crew, or scouts, or messengers. He guessed that they could be dangerous, but only in their own defense, or their master's. They did not seem warlike. There was, in fact, something pitiful about them. Most of the crew was now defunct. Their master was gone. And Eddie believed they knew it somehow. It was not menace, they projected, but a strange, inhuman sadness. Old and almost worn out, they paced and rolled and wriggled their anxious way around the worry track they had dug in this godforsaken clearing, and it almost seemed to Eddie that he could read the confused run of their thoughts. Oh, dear, what now? What is our purpose now that he is gone? And who will take care of us now that he is gone? Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear. Eddie felt a tug on the back of his leg and came very close to screaming in fear and surprise. He wheeled, cocking Roland's gun, and saw Susanna looking up at him with wide eyes. Eddie let out a long breath and dropped the hammer carefully back to its resting position. He knelt, put his hands on Susanna's shoulders, kissed her cheek, then whispered in her ear, "I came really close to putting a bullet in your silly head. What are you doing here?" "Wanted to see?" she whispered back, looking not even slightly abashed. Her eyes shifted to Roland as he also hunkered beside her. "Besides, it was spooky back there by myself." She had sustained a number of small scratches crawling after them through the brush. But Roland had to admit to himself that she could be as quiet as a ghost when she wanted to be. He hadn't heard a thing.
He took a rag, the last remnant of his old shirt, from his back pocket, and wiped the little trickles of blood from her arms. He examined his work for a moment, and then dabbed at a small nick on her forehead as well.
"Have your look, then," he said. His voice was hardly more than the movement of his lips. "I guess you earned it."
He used one hand to open a sightline at her level in the hock and greenberry bushes, then waited while she stared raptly into the clearing. At last she pulled back, and Roland allowed the bushes to close again.
"I feel sorry for them," she whispered. "Isn't that crazy?"
"Not at all," Roland whispered back. "They are creatures of great sadness, I think, in their own strange way. Eddie is going to put them out of their misery."
Eddie began to shake his head at once.
"Yes, you are. Unless you want to hunker here in what you call the tulies all night. Go for the hats, the little twirling things."
"What if I miss?"
Eddie whispered at him furiously. Roland shrugged.
Eddie stood up and reluctantly cocked the gunslinger's revolver again. He looked through the bushes at the circling servo mechanisms, going around and around in their lonely, useless orbit. "It'll be like shooting puppies," he thought glumly. Then he saw one of them. It was the thing that looked like a walking box, extrude an ugly-looking pincer device from its middle and clamp it for a moment on the snake. The snake made a surprised buzzing sound and leaped ahead. The walking box withdrew its pincer.
"Well, maybe not exactly like shooting puppies," Eddie decided. He glanced at Roland again. Roland looked back expressionlessly, arms folded across his chest.
"You pick some goddamn strange times to keep school, buddy." Eddie thought of Susanna, first shooting the bear in the ass, then blowing its sensor device to smithereens as it bore down on her and Roland, and felt a little ashamed of himself. And there was more. Part of him wanted to go for it, just as part of him had wanted to go up against Balazar and his crew of plug uglies in the Leaning Tower. The compulsion was probably sick, but that didn't change its basic attraction. Let's see who walks away. Let's just see. Yeah, that was pretty sick, all right. "Pretend it's just a shooting gallery and you want to win your honey a stuffed dog," he thought. "Or a stuffed bear." He drew a bead on the walking box and then looked around impatiently when Roland touched his shoulder.
"Say your lesson, Eddie, and be true."
Eddie hissed impatiently through his teeth, angry at the distraction. But Roland's eyes didn't flinch, and so he drew a deep breath and tried to clear everything from his mind. The squeaks and squalls of equipment that had been running too long, the aches and pains in his body, the knowledge that Susanna was here, propped up on the heels of her hands, watching, the further knowledge that she was closest to the ground, and if he missed one of the gadgets out there, she would be the handiest target if it decided to retaliate.
"I do not shoot with my hand. He who shoots with his hand has forgotten the face of his father." That was a joke, he thought. He would know his old man if he passed him on the street. But he could feel the words doing their work, clearing his mind and settling his nerves. He didn't know if he was the stuff of which gunslingers were made. The idea seemed fabulously unlikely to him, even though he knew he had managed to hold up his end pretty well during the shootout at Balazar's nightclub. But he did know that part of him liked the coldness that fell over him when he spoke the words of the old, old catechism the gunslinger had taught them. The coldness and the way things seemed to stand forth with their own breathless clarity. There was another part of him which understood that this was just another deadly drug, not much different from the heroin which had killed Henry and almost killed him. But that did not alter the thin, tight pleasure of the moment. It drummed in him like taut cables vibrating in a high wind.
"I do not aim with my hand. He who aims with his hand has forgotten the face of his father. I aim with my eye. I do not kill with my gun. He who kills with his gun has forgotten the face of his father."
Then, without knowing he meant to do it, he stepped out of the trees and spoke to the trundling robots on the far side of the clearing.
"I kill with my heart."
They stopped their endless circling. One of them let out a high buzz that might have been alarm or a warning. The radar dishes, each no bigger than half a Hershey bar, turned toward the sound of his voice. Eddie began to fire. The sensors exploded like clay pigeons, one after the other. Pity was gone from Eddie's heart. There was only that coldness and the knowledge that he would not stop, could not stop, until the job was done. Thunder filled the twilit clearing and bounced back from the splintery rock wall at its wide end. The steel snake did two cartwheels and lay twitching in the dust. The biggest mechanism, the one that had reminded Eddie of his childhood Tonka tractor, tried to flee. Eddie blew its radar dish to Kingdom Come as it made a herky-jerky run at the side of the rut. It fell on its squarish nose with thin blue flames squirting out of the steel sockets which held its glass eyes. The only sensor he missed was the one on the stainless steel rat. That shot caromed off its metal back with a high mosquito whine. It surged out of the rut, made a half-circle around the box-shaped thing which had been following the snake, and charged across the clearing at surprising speed. It was making an angry, clittering sound, and as it closed the distance, Eddie could see it had a mouth lined with long, sharp points. They did not look like teeth. They looked like sewing machine needles, blurring up and down. No, he guessed these things were really not much like puppies after all. "Take it, Roland!" he shouted desperately. But when he snatched a quick look around, he saw that Roland was still standing with his arms crossed on his chest, his expression serene and distant. He might have been thinking of chess problems or old love letters. The dish on the rat's back suddenly locked down. It changed direction slightly and buzzed straight toward Susanna Dean. "One bullet left," Eddie thought. "If I miss, it'll take her face off." Instead of shooting, he stepped forward and kicked the rat as hard as he could. He had replaced his shoes with a pair of deerskin moccasins, and he felt the jolt all the way up to his knee. The rat gave a rusty, ratcheting squeal, tumbled over and over in the dirt, and came to rest on its back. Eddie could see what looked like a dozen stubby mechanical legs pistoning up and down. Each was tipped with a sharp steel claw. These claws twirled around and around on gimbals the size of pencil erasers. A steel rod poked out of the robot's midsection and flipped the gadget upright again. Eddie brought Roland's revolver down, ignoring a momentary impulse to steady it with his free hand. That might be the way cops in his own world were taught to shoot, but it wasn't the way it was done here. "When you forget the gun is there, when it feels like you're shooting with your finger," Roland had told them, "then you'll be somewhere near home." Eddie pulled the trigger. The tiny radar dish, which had begun to turn again in an effort to find the enemies, disappeared in a blue flash. The rat made a choked noise, gulp, and fell dead on its side. Eddie turned, with his heart jackhammering in his chest. He couldn't remember being this furious since he realized that Roland meant to keep him in his world until his goddamn tower was won or lost. Probably until they were all worm chow, in other words. He leveled the empty gun at Roland's heart and spoke in a thick voice he hardly recognized as his own.
"If there was a round left in this, you could stop worrying about your fucking tower right now."
"Stop it, Eddie," Susanna said sharply. He looked at her.
"It was going for you, Susanna, and I meant to turn you into ground chuck.
But it didn't get me. You got it, Eddie. You got it."
"No thanks to him."
Eddie made as if to reholster the gun, and then realized to his further disgust that he had nothing to put it in. Susanna was wearing the holster. "Him and his lessons. Him and his goddamn lessons." He turned to Roland.
"I tell you, for 2 cents," Roland's mildly interested expression suddenly changed. His eyes shifted to a point over Eddie's left shoulder.
"Down!" he shouted. Eddie didn't ask questions. His rage and confusion were wiped from his mind immediately. He dropped, and as he did, he saw the gunslinger's left hand blur down to his side.
"My God," he thought, still falling. "He can't be that fast. No one can be that fast. I'm not bad, but Susanna makes me look slow, and he makes Susanna look like a turtle trying to walk uphill on a piece of glass."
Something passed just over his head, something that squealed at him in mechanical rage and pulled out a tuft of his hair. Then the gunslinger was shooting from the hip, 3 fast shots like thunder cracks, and the squealing stopped.
A creature which looked to Eddie like a large mechanical bat thudded to earth between the place where Eddie now lay and the one where Susanna knelt beside Roland. One of its jointed, rust-speckled wings thumped the ground once, weakly, as if angry at the mischance, and then became still. Roland crossed to Eddie, walking easy in his old sprung boots. He extended a hand. Eddie took it and let Roland help him to his feet. The wind had been knocked out of him, and he found he couldn't talk. Probably just as well. Seems like every time I open my mouth, I stick my goddamn foot into it.
Eddie, you all right?
Susanna was crossing the clearing to where he stood with his head bent and his hands planted on his upper thighs, trying to breathe.
Yeah.
The word came out in a croak. He straightened up with an effort.
Just got a little haircut.
It was in a tree, Roland said mildly. I didn't see it myself at first. The light gets tricky this time of day. He paused, and then went on in that same mild voice. She was never in any danger, Eddie. Eddie nodded his head. Roland, he now realized, could almost have eaten a hamburger and drunk a milkshake before beginning his draw. He was that fast.
All right. Let's just say I disapprove of your teaching techniques, okay? I'm not going to apologize, though, so if you're waiting for one, you can stop now.
Roland bent, picked Susanna up, and began to brush her off. He did this with a kind of impartial affection, like a mother brushing off her toddler after she's taken one of her necessary tumbles in the dust of the backyard. "Your apology is not expected or necessary," he said. "Susanna and I had a conversation similar to this one 2 days ago, didn't we, Susanna?" She nodded. Roland's of the opinion that apprentice gunslingers who won't bite the hand that feeds them from time to time need a good kick in the slats. Eddie looked around at the wreckage and slowly began to beat the bone dust out of his pants and shirt.
"What if I told you I don't want to be a gunslinger, Roland, old buddy?"
"I'd say that what you want doesn't much matter." Roland was looking at the metal kiosk which stood against the rock wall and seemed to have lost interest in the conversation. Eddie had seen this before. When the conversation turned to questions of should be, could be, or ought to be, Roland almost always lost interest.
"Ka?"
Eddie asked with a trace of his old bitterness.
"That's right. Ka."
Roland walked over to the kiosk and passed a hand along the yellow and black stripes which ran down its front. "We have found one of the 12 portals which ring the edge of the world. One of the 6 paths to the Dark Tower. And that is also Ka."
"27. Eddie went back for Susanna's wheelchair. No one had to ask him to do this. He wanted some time alone, to get himself back under control. Now that the shooting was over, every muscle in his body seemed to have picked up its own little thrumming tremor. He did not want either of them to see him this way, not because they might misread it as fear, but because one or both might know it for what it really was, excitement overload. He had liked it. Even when you added in the bat which had almost scalped him, he had liked it.
That's bullshit, buddy, and you know it."
The trouble was, he didn't know it. He had come face to face with something Susanna had found out for herself after shooting the bear. He could talk about how he didn't want to be a gunslinger, how he didn't want to be tramping around this crazy world where the three of them seemed to be the only human life, that what he really wanted, more than anything else, was to be standing on the corner of Broadway and 42nd Street, popping his fingers, munching a chili dog, and listening to Creedence Clearwater Revival blast out of his Walkman earphones as he watched the girls go by, those ultimately sexy New York girls with their pouty go-to-hell mouths and their long legs and short skirts. He could talk about those things until he was blue in the face. But his heart knew other things. It knew that he had enjoyed blowing the electronic menagerie back to glory,
At least while the game was on and Roland's gun was his own private handheld thunderstorm, he had enjoyed kicking the robot rat, even though it had hurt his foot and even though he had been scared shitless. In some weird way, that part, the being scared part, actually seemed to add to the enjoyment. All that was bad enough, but his heart knew something even worse, that if a door leading back to New York appeared in front of him right now, he might not walk through it. Not, at least, until he had seen the Dark Tower for himself. He was beginning to believe that Roland's illness was a communicable disease. As he wrestled Susanna's chair through the tangle of junk alders, cursing the branches that whipped at his face and tried to poke his eyes out, Eddie found himself able to admit at least some of these things, and the admission cooled his blood a little. "I want to see if it looks the way it did in my dream," he thought. "To see something like that, that would be really fantastic." And another voice spoke up inside. "I'll bet his other friends, the ones with the names that sound like they came straight from the round table in King Arthur's court, I'll bet they felt the same way, Eddie. And they're all dead. Every one of them." He recognized that voice, like it or not. It belonged to Henry, and that made it a hard voice not to hear. Roland, with Susanna balanced on his right hip, was standing in front of the metal box that looked like a subway entrance closed for the night. Eddie left the wheelchair at the edge of the clearing and walked over. As he did, the steady humming noise and the vibration under his feet became louder. The machinery making the noise, he realized, was either inside the box or under it. It seemed that he heard it not with his ears, but somewhere deep inside his head, and in the hollows of his gut. "So this is one of the 12 portals. Where's it go, Roland? Disney World?" Roland shook his head. "I don't know where it goes. Maybe nowhere. Or everywhere. There's a lot about my world I don't know. Surely you both have realized that. And there are things I used to know which have changed."
"Because the world has moved on."
"Yes." Roland glanced at him. "Here, that is not a figure of speech. The world really is moving on, and it goes ever faster. At the same time, things are wearing out, falling apart." He kicked the mechanical corpse of the walking box to illustrate his point. Eddie thought of the rough diagram of the portals which Roland had drawn in the dirt.
"Is this the edge of the world?"
he asked, almost timidly.
"I mean, it doesn't look much different than any place else."
He laughed a little.
"If there's a drop-off, I don't see it."
Roland shook his head. "It's not that kind of edge. It's the place where one of the beams starts, or so I was taught."
"Beams?"
Susanna asked. "What beams?" "The great old ones didn't make the world, but they did remake it. Some tale-tellers say the beams saved it. Others say they are the seeds of the world's destruction. The great old ones created the beams. They are lines of some sort, lines which bind and hold."
"Are you talking about magnetism?"
Susanna asked cautiously.
His whole face lit up, transforming its harsh planes and furrows into something new and amazing.
And for a moment Eddie knew how Roland would look if he actually did reach his tower.
"Yes. Not just magnetism, but that is a part of it, and gravity, and the proper alignment of space, size, and dimension. The beams are the forces which bind these things together."
"Welcome to physics in the nut house," Eddie said in a low voice. Susanna ignored this.
"And the Dark Tower? Is it some kind of generator, a central power source for these beams?"
"I don't know."
"But you do know that this is point A," Eddie said. "If we walked long enough in a straight line, we'd come to another portal, call it point C, on the other edge of the world. But before we did, we'd come to point B, the center point, the Dark Tower."
The gunslinger nodded.
"How long a trip is it, do you know?"
"No,
But I know it's very far, and that the distance grows with every day that passes.